I have a treat for you today. We're going back to Bonaventure Cemetery with a tour guide this time. He is amazing, and his name is Shannon Scott. And he has been giving tours of Savannah cemeteries for well over 20 years. We had that instant TAFO friend connection and had a really great discussion about a famous sculptor in Bonaventure because he sculpted over 70 amazing funerary art pieces. What lies beneath? Shannon Scott and Bonaventure sculptor John Walls. Friends and Taphophiles, I'm your host, Lachelle. I'm excited about our interview with a Taphophile today because I found a great Taphophile. His name is Shannon Scott, and he is taking us back to Bonaventure Cemetery, one of our favorites. And today, I'm fulfilling a promise I made on one of our Bonaventure episodes to go back and talk about this amazing sculptor that is so famous to Bonaventure because of the wide range of sculpts that he did and amazing funerary art pieces. There are many grieving maidens, all kinds of angels, cherubs, doves, of course, the gamut of florals and the urns with flames, winged hourglasses, family crests, crosses, you name it, John Walls has sculpted it. One of my favorites is a beautiful angel that is a child, and she is pure white with exquisite wings holding a giant seashell. And she's looking down into it as if it's full of water, and she's looking into a reflection. Just stunning. And another favorite is a grave that people call the Hartman twins. Although they were not twins, they were siblings, but they never knew each other. They had been born and passed at different times, but are buried there in Bonaventure next to each other. And so they have a gorgeous memorial made to them by John Walls, and they're lying on what could be a tiny crib, and they're laying there together, little sculptures of two little babies holding hands and eyes closed in sleep. It is very touching. He had just an amazing way about expressing himself in stone. I can't wait to share more about John Walls with you and to let you get to know Shannon Scott a little better. We're so lucky today to have Shannon Scott.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. Shannon Scott Tours and Events is kind of the bigger brand in that we do lots of things or lots of events and tours that cover different areas of Georgia, the coastal areas mostly, but locally, Bonaventure Cemetery Journeys is like the doing business as. You know, when I started doing tours in the cemetery 20 years ago, that is what it was kind of known as, but it's right. Evolved to Shannon Scott Tours and Events.
Okay, I love it. That's perfect. So on your website, it says that you've been a 29-year resident storyteller. That sounds like a story in itself.
Well, it is, of course, and I think a few years have crept by. So I received my first tour guide license in Savannah in 1990.
Nice.
And that is when it was really meaningful to do that, because there was a 600-page booklet that, and I believe the test had 300 questions on it, some were essay. There were 40.
Oh, wow.
If I remember correctly, there was somewhere between like 25 and 40 essay questions. And it, if you were really a whippersnapper, you could get it and done in 3 hours. But it took most people three or four times to pass that test. And it was 3 hours on the minimum.
Wow, that's amazing. I guess I didn't realize there was such a thing as a tour guide test. You didn't just hang up your shingle and start giving tours.
Yeah, they threw that out the window, which, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. I feel like there should be a tourism college where you go and really learn some basics and get a certificate, kind of like the Vocare in New Orleans. But in Savannah, they kind of tossed that out the window. That had a little bit to do with a lawsuit that happened at the Supreme Court in the state, which you could say the tour guides won. And it was a free speech grounds case.
Interesting. Yeah, because when I was there, there was like a billion tour guides everywhere.
Yeah, it's open season now.
But anyway, so the main ones that you give are at the cemeteries and some of Savannah's historical sites, right?
That's correct. I mean, our bread and butter is the daily tour of Bonaventure Cemetery, and we were the first on-the-ground tour company there 20 years ago, which was just me, you know. But it took about a decade for that to hit, where it became like a popular thing to do in Savannah. But we also tour Laurel Grove North, Laurel Grove South,
which I love.
By 1900, so those are traditionally our only Victorian cemeteries. You know, Bonaventure is 20 and 21st century as well. And if a Taffophile comes to town or a history buff or just a story buff, they can do private tours with me. And for the right customer, I mean, I can do 7 cemeteries in a day.
Goodness. Well, we will definitely have to do some tours next time.
Yeah.
Because I'm definitely coming back to Savannah. I loved Savannah.
I can tell you love Savannah. Your podcast shows and your social media shows that you have a thing for Savannah. I'm just accusing you openly.
I will accept it. I will take that.
It's no secret. I'm serious.
That's true. No secret there. No. So I follow you, of course, social media, and I love all of your great posts and videos that you do of Bonaventure, and it just makes me lonely for Bonaventure. I really loved it so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the whole idea.
And so we've done a couple episodes. We've talked about Noble Jones, and we've talked about, you know, the Telfair, all of those, the kind of the beginnings of Bonaventure Cemetery. And in one of the episodes, we talked about Little Gracie and her story, which of course then led to talking about the man that actually sculpted that amazing lifelike sculpture of Gracie, John Walls. And I heard you talking about him the other day.
He is my spiritual employer. You know, I always say that, you know, you could say in some sense three people, or I should say three people or maybe three entities made Bonaventure. One was the 19th century photographer Jerome Wilson. He published the first and the most extensive collection of stereo views out of the cemetery. So he was prolific. Then we see John Walls, the sculptor, who really from 1889 to 1922 decorated it for us. And then we see, of course, you know, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, the novel of 1993, puts it on the map internationally again. But, you know, even though that's uber popular and is really probably by reputation or even a deeper understanding brings the masses, it's really John Walls that defined the visual aesthetic, the visual landscape. And, you know, I feel so grateful for him. And I hope he knows that somewhere. I truly am grateful. I celebrate him every day.
That's so true. And as I started looking into all that he had sculpted there, I said, someday I've got to do an episode just about John Walls. And then I heard you talking about him and I thought, you know, I might be able to kill two birds with one stone here. I might be able to talk to Shannon Scott and be able to talk about John Walls.
Certainly.
So first, I want you to tell us kind of how you got to be interested in cemeteries. It sounds like you were taphophile before taphophile was cool.
Yes, before it was actually in the Webster's Merriam Dictionary and just in the Urban Dictionary, I was cool, unofficially or something. But
right.
Well, I mean, the short of the long is I had two wonderful, I still have two wonderful teacher parents, although now retired, and my brother Jay and I, with my parents, they were wonderful in that they took us Griswold style around the United States in the summers when they were out. I mean, the whole Chevy Malibu station wagon in our case, but with the seat facing backwards on the highway.
Yes.
And, you know, by the time I was in the eighth grade, I'd been to at least half the states of the United States, and I'd seen the majority of the major federal sites and many of the state historical sites. You know, Williamsburg was a
nice.
Childhood favorite. So
yeah.
Graveyards and cemeteries and other types of burials of the, you know, Native Americans, mound builders. I mean, the Cahokia Mounds are not too far from where I grew up. So that all became a part of the energy and the vibe. And then in high school for 2 years, I had a summer job working in a cemetery called Maplewood Cemetery in Rantoul, Illinois.
Oh.
In 1840. And it was sort of surrounded by cornfields. And it was always an escape place for me where I could just go hang out and look at the stars or take a date and have a picnic. And
right.
Or if I felt, you know, poetic, I'd go write some poetry in the cemetery, you know, kind of Lord Byron style.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but the whole time, you know, I'm mowing around these gravestones, you know, old and new, and I'm reading dates and inscriptions and looking at textures. And then at one point I was digging graves, and so I felt a tenderness or a care to be a good steward. And so anyway, all said and done, I land in Savannah, Georgia, full of cemeteries and other great stuff. So I was hooked.
That all resonates with me. Same kind of thing. I think is, if you go to cemeteries in your childhood, it becomes normalized. It doesn't seem scary. It doesn't seem that weird.
No, not at all. I mean, I just had very special friendship moments in them, you know, and then also just other revelations. And also, you know, there were, I think I had as a high school kid, I was kind of the inner resident and the only goth kid in my high school. I flirted with speed metal too, so, you know, I kind of ran the gambit, but I definitely had big black hair at one time and eyeliner and the whole deal. So, but, you know, I didn't fit in always, even though most of the people in my small town were incredible and really nice to me and understanding, although they just thought I was either weird or cool, but didn't hate on me too much. But, you know, like, I could go and escape from what I thought was my, you know, little backwards town, you know, in the cemetery, whatever. And, you know, that, and some of that's just youthful attitude.
Right. Yeah, of course.
But I've always said, and I say it more than ever now, that, you know, taphophiles really go to cemeteries to recharge for life. Like, we get away from the toll of the living to recharge inside of the cemeteries, and that gives us, almost like going to the beach and getting that energy off of the water, we get this kind of other energy off of those places in nature, like cemeteries, and we just take that back to our living lives. So I go to them to recharge as well as learn.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, too, it gives you that, oh, just that remembrance that life is fleeting. You know, that we aren't promised any more days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helps you kind of honor the people that are there, but also remember to make the most of the time that you have as well.
Absolutely. No, for sure. No, the sense of mortality is very definite. And I think it's about, I was just having this conversation last night because this is, you know, how taphophiles talk.
This is what we talk about. Yes.
Yeah. This is just like, you know, this is just everyday stuff. Like it's our, it's like the, our version of the weather, you know, but no, we were just talking about making a friend with death and seeing death, almost humanizing death as in a person and making a friend with it without getting too gloomy and morbid. But I mean, I really have no fear of death. I mean, I really don't. And partly maybe because of the comfort I've found in cemetery.
You know, death used to really freak me out. I mean, as a kid, as a teenager, you know, young adult, I mean, I just get so emotional about, you know, death and I'm not being very eloquent here, but probably freak me out is the best, you know, I can say. But I've always loved cemeteries, but I feel like, especially after I fought a battle with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and had to, you know, have chemotherapy and, you know, and there at the beginning when you hear the words cancer and, you know that you have a big fight on your hands, like you don't know if you're going to make it. You know, you don't know how bad things are. You just hear, you know, that C word and it's bad. And so I don't know if going through that a couple years ago, because it's been as I've kind of recovered from this, that my love of cemeteries has really grown more. And so I don't know, maybe this is part for me of a healing process and understanding maybe a little bit more about death. And I think also in our society, we don't talk about it enough.
Yeah, no, I feel like that's the, you know, like along with everything else we're not taught, which I feel like it's almost somebody not wanting us to know about it or talk about it. But yeah, it's like you're not learning as a kid, like some of these more really spiritual aspects of. It's like everyone wants to shield, and it's, you know, it's all supposed to be happy, shiny, and all that. But you know, I admit I grew up in the suburbs and had a fairly comfortable Midwestern life, although my parents weren't rich or anything. But you know, I didn't know a lot of death. You know, it might have been different for me if I grew up in a place where there was.
Right.
I slowly learned about it. You know, like thankfully or whatever. But it's like, you know, nobody was throwing it in my face. I wasn't in a war zone. You know, so. But all that said, you know, I'm glad to be a voice for, I don't know, maybe making people more comfortable or acquainted or whatever the case is.
Right. We're normalizing it a little bit. Now the buzzword is death positive.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's new. All right. Not heard that.
Death positive. That's really interesting. Oh, but. Yeah. So I kind of looked that up and I'm like, okay, what are they saying this is? And I think what it's supposed to be is that we can talk about it. We can discuss these hard things. You can come to understand a little more about the process and that it isn't just that thing that's, you know, out there, but it's too scary to talk about or too gruesome to talk about.
Mm.
And I think it makes it worse. I think that's maybe why it used to freak me out so much more, is I wasn't acquainted with it. And then when it happens to someone that you care about, it's traumatic.
Yeah. I'm still thinking about death positive and how I want to make that sort of a casual greeting in the streets. Like, How are you today? Fine. Hope you have a positive death. Have a positive death. Even if I never see you again. A positive death to you, sir, madam.
Just so you know, I'm death positive.
You know. That's right. That's right. I identify as death positive.
Exactly. Oh, gosh. All right. Well, let's get into some of our stories of Bonaventure, because we could talk Taffophile talk for the next 3 hours, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I'll tell you what it kind of brings to mind, though. I mean, just kind of shifting back to John Walls. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I think about with Walls. Like, here's a guy who, like myself, is sort of a middleman, and although he's obviously more directly connected to the death and burial, you know, rituals and ornamentation. I'm just, you know, a storyteller. But I feel like, you know, talk about a guy who had to be death positive. I mean, and also acquainted and intimate with the, you know, human nature and just the whole, you know, being a good person to consult with.
Yeah. So, and that he could take something like a photo. So go back to little Gracie, take this photo of this beautiful child and then be able to recreate this lifelike, you know, literally bring life to these sculptures that he did. And you just really have to respect that.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of times as we are in a cemetery, we are so enamored with the beautiful, especially ones from that Victorian time period. You know, we're enamored by the amazing sculptures and and all of the symbols and, you know, all the gorgeous carving that you see into these stones. I think sometimes we forget that there literally was a man behind the chisel.
Yes.
Creating these things, you know, or putting that epitaph into the stone. And so I think that part is, that's really fascinating to me. So I'm excited to dive into kind of this person and kind of what he did.
I do want to say this first. I'm not claiming to be any kind of expert on the life and times of John Walls. In fact, there are local descendants who know a great deal, and I've had the pleasure of interacting with them in the past year. Even earlier, there was, and I will apologize here again, that about a decade ago, I interacted with, I want to say like a great-grandniece who had walked in the footsteps of Walls, and, you know, I'm happy to put you in touch with her, but she had traveled to Vienna where he was born and had gone to art college and had seen, basically, you know, following the footsteps of her ancestor all the way to, like, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and maybe New York. Obviously Savannah, and she's around in Savannah. But, you know, I have, like, you know, they say never meet your heroes. And, you know, in the beginning, I had this really glorious idea of John Walls. And then through the eyes of the ancestors, and obviously through his works, I mean, they're just amazing.
Right.
And by and large, but he was also a human being, and he was, he was flawed, you know, like
we all are,
you know, but he was, but I still think this guy, you know, saw the opportunity. He was ambitious. I mean, he traveled the world in the name of his ambition when there was no internet. There's barely a mail system, you know, there's barely a copyright office. There's, you know, it's all by ship. I mean, most people are too lazy to do what John Walls did.
Yeah.
In the 19th century, they could not repeat the feat, you know. But anyway, and then to mess around with these heavy stones, and then to, you know, later in his life die of really silicosis, you know, inhaling dust, and you know, it's almost like a faded artist death. It's kind of
right.
You know, fitting, but, you know, not good. But he was a dreamer, and I've been very fortunate to be around his work and to be inspired by it every day. I cannot think of a better, more ideal life for someone like myself, who is a taffophile and an art nerd and a philosophy nerd, to just wander around statues in one cemetery. And, you know, they say he did 77 statues in Bonaventure in his career. And I would say there are a few more in there that you could attribute to his studio. But
right.
That's the kind of the record. But he definitely did hundreds, if not thousands, of objects. And unfortunately, because one of the family homes was bulldozed, I believe, in the 1970s with a lot of the records of his studio in it.
Oh, that's tragic.
They're snippets, although it seems like a decade ago there was someone who had studio records of his and the family that were in an attic, and they were, you know, they had pulled them down, and, you know, I don't know what the revelations have been since then, but yeah, there were a lot of records destroyed in a bulldozing of a house, which is now part of the Savannah State University property, I believe. And so we lost a lot of insight, and that is tragic, but we have enough to piece together an interesting puzzle. And, you know, I suppose if you'd like, I can talk about, you know, his early life.
Sure, that would be fantastic. We want to learn more about
okay.
him. Yeah.
Well, let's first highlight the fact that, you know, these cemeteries were now public parks owned by private companies, and they were very interested in soliciting the public interest. And, you know, to kind of satisfy headstone demand, they really had to kind of allow or hope that European sculptors would fall into line and be a part of satisfying that demand in the United States. I mean, mm-hmm. cemeteries in other countries were very limited by mm-hmm. the space of those countries and townships, and
right.
America was where the Renaissance happened. It's wide open. So the point is, there was a lot of opportunity for stone quarries and all the rest. And, you know, what I know of Walls thus far is that he was born in Vienna, 1844. And in that hour, and this had been the case for the history of art for centuries, you typically got lined up either in doing decorative work like fountains and just other architectural features, and you were just like one maker in the process of making a building and all that. And you were anonymous, like you died anonymous, you made a lowly wage, the whole thing. And because of that demand, and this is, you know, I'm a big American dream guy, I'm a big praiser of the United States. The American dream got a new ranking, you could say, by the definition of helping these artists arrive from Europe to work here. And, you know, I tell people this all the time, that, you know, mostly a young artist like Walls in history would have signed his boss's name to something he made, and that would be the extent of his life. Now, these young guns could have an opportunity. They have a little more pull, a little more clout, and if you really wanted to sign your name to work, you wanted to have a resume that spoke of, like, at least two things, and that is,
okay,
you wanted to graduate an art academy, maybe two. Walls would graduate two, is my understanding. You wanted to win a competition every now and again, even if it was, like, seventh place, your name is suddenly in a newspaper, you know. And the third thing was finding a business person that was willing to stand next to you and help you rent or buy a marble studio so you could then hang your shingle out,
mm-hmm.
start signing your own name, right?
Okay, yeah.
So most artists fell away somewhere in that process. They never made it. And Walls, you know, here's kind of the short scope, but so he leaves Vienna when he's 13, finds his way to his sister's in Baltimore, and I believe she was a dressmaker. I'm going to say her name was Mary, but anyway, his brother Wilhelm lived in Savannah. We're going to call him Bill for short. But when the U.S. Census Bureau came around in 1860, when Walls was 16, and said, "Hey, young Walls kid, what do?" He replied, "Stonecutter." And he found his way to Philadelphia, where his sister Filipina lived, which I love that name.
Wilhelm classic, and Filipina. Classic,
yeah, right, classic Greek stuff. But nonetheless, that's where a lot of the stone quarries were, right? And this is sort of my interpretation, but I think the big jump for Walls is when he became a Freemason.
Oh.
And suddenly he's being acquainted with these biblical symbols, these symbols of antiquity by the Lodes. And he's got this carbon gift to go along with it, and this is upping the ante for him. And eventually he finds his way into the art academies of Austria and Germany, is my understanding. I don't know the names of those academies yet, but
right.
But he graduates too, is the point. He's got that going for him. He speaks the language already, obviously. But eventually he finds his way around. This is my date, but 1870 to 1872, he found his way to the studio of Ami Mallet. Now, Ami Mallet was a notable Parisian sculptor, famously did the dome for the Paris Opera House. And
wow.
This is where, as a young art student, I went to SCAD, or Savannah College of Art and Design, studying fine arts, so this is where I identify with him too, obviously. But, I'm thinking, what is Walls doing in Paris? He's going to all the cool museums and looking at the architecture.
Right.
And he's got his satchel on. He goes over to the Louvre and maybe runs around Versailles, and he's sketching, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so it's there that he makes some master copies of some famous masterworks by the Greek sculptor Praxiteles, Michelangelo, da-da-da. And he shows the master, Mallet, that he has, what it takes. And you could almost say Mallet, in some sense of the idea, rubber stamps his career. And he finds his way back to Philadelphia, I believe. And somewhere in that, the Gettysburg Battlefield competition happens in 1889. And I want to back up a little bit. There was a... this is a freakish minute on my tour, but years ago, I've had some freakish Walls experiences on my tour, let me tell you. But I had this guy on my tour with this Eastern European accent I didn't quite recognize. And I said, "Hey man, where are you from?" And he was like, "Bulgaria." I was like, "Bulgaria? I've got a friend from Sofia." And as we were going along, this guy tells me that he has seen a John Walls monument in the mountains of Bulgaria.
Really?
I'm like, what? So I don't know the whole story, but sometime in April of 1876, there was a tragic slaughter the numbers run the gambit, but somewhere between, and this is quite a gambit, 1,200 and 8,000 Christians, Christian Bulgarians, were slaughtered by the Ottoman Empire. And Walls, Walls may tie into, this could tie into his life in Paris, from a timeline standpoint. But all that said, I don't know this whole story. But he either partially contributed or won some kind of commission to make this monument in the mountains of Bulgaria. So this puts him on the map. This puts him on the map. I want to see a movie of his life. You know what I'm saying? I'm pleading with filmmakers out there. Someone make a movie about this guy. So, but when he finds his way back to Philly, there's obviously a big time leap there. But between 1876 and 1889, I'm guessing he's staying busy. But the Gettysburg moment is really the world-renowned rock star moment. There was a monument that had been unveiled to the Pennsylvania 106th Infantry that had not been satisfying to some people. And I think they opened up a secondary competition, and he submitted a wax model of his proposal, a drawing. They thought it was awesome. And so he unveils the Silence Drums of Gettysburg. And in those same hours, he received some kind of letter from his favorite professor in Vienna, who is basically saying that the Telfair Museum in Savannah, Georgia, had ordered these five statues. It's pretty clear cut. It's like, hey, come pick these up, bring them to Savannah, and I'll pay you some money. And John, of course, is thinking, I'll say hello to my brother Bill and all the rest. And Now, I think there was a caveat in the deal, and that was John said he would do it. He would pick the statues up and do all the installation, except he wanted to carve the statue of Raphael. So in the group of the five artist statues still standing there, the one of Raphael was done by John Walls. And so,
oh, neat.
Yeah, so I think he and his brother Bill, who worked for a hotel in Savannah, he's got some sense that Savannians are frustrated that they have to wait 5, 10, even 30 years to get, a monument of his kind of abilities, from some other city or Europe or wherever. And there's a need, and he's going to fill that gap. It's a big fish, small pond story. So that's what I mean. Some of the descendants claim, well, he wasn't maybe that great with money and da da da. But I'm like, well, he kind of knew. He was a hustler at some level. So he opens up that studio at Bull and Jones Street and effectively sets, Bonaventure on fire with his works.
Wow.
And you could almost say the rest is history. But I want to say this, though. One thing that really fell into line for his life was in 1905, there was a widow, Sarah Gilmore, who basically her husband, John, I believe, he owned a stone quarry business, and I'm sure John had purchased things from them and knew them, and like they all did. And Sarah's husband dies, and this is just my interpretation, but she needed a man's name on that legal document to keep that stone quarry up and running.
Hmm.
And it does seem very much not a marriage so much of love, but convenience, and then maybe some love, although that is hotly debated, believe me.
Huh.
There's no one has a photograph of her.
Wow.
There are some very interesting choices she made after John Walls died about things regarding his life and times that, I will touch on some of those, but I will leave others alone. but the bottom line is she was 30 years his junior. He had never married, which I did not know that until recently before her. So I thought, in my mind, I'm like, oh, he got married to a young woman.
Right.
But he married he was 60, basically. And
yeah, I read that he was 63 or something when
that's
he married.
Yeah,
and I thought, wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, was he a man about town? Was he just dedicated to his career? Was he, did he have other preferences? I mean, anyway, we don't know, I don't think.
Right.
There wasn't a lot of love possibly there. It was just really an arrangement. And that's the way it feels to me, because some of that is just not known, right? But anyway, one of the unfortunate, let me go back. I mean, now that he's put his name on the document of the stone quarry, or the quarry business, stone yard business, I mean, now he controls the supply line. I mean, that is a win-win. I mean, that's the American dream personified,
True.
He wasn't just some runt. He wasn't just some runt in, Rodin's studio. I mean, he is out full force. Like, I'm the owner of this quarry stone yard. I'm the sculptor. I'm the everything, So, yay for John Walls. It's a rags-to-riches story. It's an American dream tale come true. And then, of course, it's a Bonaventure gift times, eternity.
Right.
But, the one thing that did happen, and I think this is why there is a rift in between some of the family members, and it's completely understandable, and it's no one's fault in a sense, but Sarah's brother was Walls' right-hand guy, and not long after their marriage, I can't remember the exact date, so forgive me, I'm just going to say 1915 or something, but They were moving a piece of marble off of a ship on River Street. The stone fell onto the brother, Sarah's brother, and
yikes!
I know it punctured a lung. I don't recall right off the top of my head if he died then or he died of residual effects sometime later. But it seems like they blame John for the error, and this is where very uncomfortable feeling begins, and you know, again, I'm not pointing fingers. I'm just saying this is what I've been told by family,
right,
to some extent. So it's just what happened. But that some of that still exists today. Some of that awkwardness towards each other still exists from that moment on the river long ago. But and I'm sure John, being John, I would like to think, you know, he really lamented everything and, you know, wanted to make things right. But I don't know. I don't know. It doesn't sound like it got healed.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the close of that is that at 78 years of age, you know, and I don't know when he was diagnosed and with silicosis, but, you know, from all the quarry dust and
wow,
he just wheezed to death, basically. Yeah.
Aww.
And of course, you know, that's just the timeline. And we can, of course, move along and around a little, Gracie, too. I just wanted to kind of cover his life and times a little bit.
No, and yeah, I love that. And I thought that one of the saddest parts of his story was that he made all these amazing monuments for everyone else, but he actually didn't have one for quite a long time or something like that.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first came here as a young artist and I was hanging around in Bonaventure, I wanted to see the grave of John Walls. And I think I was probably, you know, 19 or whatever. But I noticed, of course, you know, there were these headstones in the John Walls plot in Bonaventure. And because I'd worked in a cemetery, I recognized the fact that his plot had a foundation, some broken grout, and someone had made an attempt with Georgia garden tiles, the terracotta tiles, sometimes called slave tiles. They had made a circular planter area for like a tree or a flower or a shrub, very small, behind the headstone, almost like some token thing for Walls. And who knows if anybody has a memory of who put that there. But
yeah,
the point is, there had been something there. I knew that was a clue. But the Historical Society had no concept. There seemed to be nothing at that time in the record. I don't even know if there still is in the public record sense. And it was a mystery. It was like, okay, John Walls, cobbler without shoes, no headstone.
Yeah.
And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, what happened was, through the years of touring in Bonaventure, the families started to come out and take tours with me. And sometimes they just showed up randomly on the tour and told me stories. And one of the family members said that Sarah had had a headstone made. She was dissatisfied with it. She had it destroyed. And before she could make another, she herself died. Now, I think there's some credibility to that. I think there's also, that is a covering up in a politically correct way, that she may have been, you know, making a statement there. But, you know, I can't prove that. Now, the other element is that the other half of the family told me that no other stonecutter in town was willing to touch it because they were superstitious about giving Walls the master this finale marker, that it might that might be the death of them in business. Now, that is legitimate. I've seen that and have read that in many aspects of the art world, particularly around sculpture and also cemetery monument makers. No one wants to give that guy or be the guy to do that headstone. So that is all that I knew for a while. And then some of the other descendants, you know, we kind of intermingled in the past year, one of whom has been a tour guide in the cemetery now and again. But they really felt like that Sarah may have intended to replace it, but something went down where, and no one really has a solid theory on this, but it just seems like some series of extenuating things ultimately prompted her to destroy the headstone. And the fact that there's no photograph of Sarah, no one really knows a lot about her, and really some of the afterward, it just seems like it might have been something egregious. But you know, I don't want to like get all soap opera. I'm just saying,
right,
it feels
it's
a little
mysterious.
It feels a little icky. I'm just, you know,
yeah,
it feels a little icky, but that's, I don't want to harp on that. It's just interesting, obviously.
Yeah, that's mysterious.
But He now has a headstone, I should just say. Let's talk about the positive.
Yes, he does.
he now has a headstone thanks to Virginia Mobley and Dan Mobley, may he rest in peace, of Oglethorpe Marble and Granite Company of the past 116, 18 years or whatever it's been for them. But Virginia Mobley, who still runs the family business, and she is a spry, a woman of a certain age, but she is still answering that phone at that company. But she was basically contracted by the Bonaventure Historical Society to design a monument, and it's wonderful. And Dan helped install it. He passed away in 2020. And by the way, he was my buddy. I miss Dan Mobley. Yeah, he was a gentle soul and a wise old soul and a funny guy, but he was in the Bonaventure all the time, cleaning monuments, installing headstones, the rest. But Virginia gave this, the headstone has, it's a 19th century piece of Georgia marble, which is amazing because, you know, those quarries are closed. And the fact that it was found at all is a miracle, but it's like a gift from God. And Virginia left it unfinished as a statement of Wall's still out there in the eternal, you know, that his life didn't really end. He's still making art in heaven or whatever. So it's an unfinished headstone. But in the finished part
cool.
of it, you have three carving tools: mallet, chisel, scraping tool. And as I tell people, Wall's basically was one of the last old schoolers. Electric pneumatic tools not really come onto line until 4 years after he was dead. So all of those statues that people see in Bonaventure and other places that he made were basically made with those three tools. Yeah, obviously some templates. There were some fast, you know, things you could do with templates, but it's all by hand. He had no eraser. So I tell people, like a tattoo artist, man, you wanted to get that line right the first time. You had no eraser.
Yeah, you either have to start completely again. Unlike a tattoo artist, I don't know, they can't take it off. But
yeah, I don't know. I'm not that. I have no tattoos. But yeah,
me neither.
Just, yeah, it's just a, you know, it's an incredible life and times. And man, am I so lucky to call him my spiritual boss.
I like that. I love that. Your spiritual boss.
Thank you, John Walls, sir.
Yeah. So tell us about some of his sculptures there in Bonaventure. What are some of your favorites?
I'm particularly fond of, I mean, I think his finest work in terms of detail and overall survival is the depiction as a maiden sitting on top of Golgotha, contemplating the crucifixion, eternal wreath in one hand, passion flower crawling up the back towards her, you know, exposed forward foot, which is very tantamount to those types of statues. And it is sort of a, you know, a Sister Mary, Mother Mary-like figure, but it's just kind of a general maiden. But the Owenstein family own the Savannah Shipping Company, and they take such exceptional care of that wall statue, and so my hat's off to them, because I think even though it's not his most famous, it's completely unmissable.
Right, I know the one you're talking about. I love it. Yeah, beautiful.
It survived because any artist knows that drawing hands convincingly, drawing feet convincingly, is a monster unless you're just naturally gifted. The fact that he could do that so well with every quirky digit out of solid stone, I mean, that's just amazing.
It really is. It just is mind-blowing when you see a really good sculpture just thinking that this is stone. A guy carved this out of stone. It just is mind-blowing to me.
It is. It's, I mean, it's a calling that you obviously have to answer if that is what's in yourself. And Walls did 1,000 times. And I've heard, and I can't validate this, but, you know, I've heard that he worked on even Stone Mountain, Georgia in some capacity, but I'm still trying to vet that. But, you know, this guy was busy. I mean, he had minions like Antonio Leafy from Sicily was his right-hand guy.
Yeah.
And there are nameless minions, you know, in that studio history that did did die anonymously. Like, we'll probably never know that they worked for John Wallace. But he had a lot of help, and the U.S. Copyright Office helped him too, because he, you know, with the advent of photography came catalogs, and he would show up to a town with a statue and see that someone had ripped him off from a catalog photograph, and and he took some to court, and he, you know, he won some, he lost some. But he used that benefit of the U.S. Copyright Office to protect some of his bigger works.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's fascinating. I can't get enough of this fact, by the way. I think it's fascinating that if you paid him to autograph your headstone, he charged you twice the cost of the whole monument.
Really?
And we're talking the gold dollar era, which no one has a memory of, by the way. Money was worth something. You had just paid this sculptor double of hundreds or thousands for his autograph. I mean, that is baller status, if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah. Wow, that is nuts.
Yeah, I know, right? I always love bragging on that fact, because I'm a big fan of, like, economic history and the U.S. dollar and the tragedy of our dollar. So
yeah.
I love reminding people what it could buy you at one time. Walls's autograph, no less.
Yeah, exactly.
The rock star.
All right. Well, what else did he do?
Well, of course, you know, let's not dance around it any longer, shall we? Little Gracie, easily the most famous piece of portrait made art ever carved in Savannah, Georgia, is the statue of the nearly 7-year-old girl, Little Gracie Watson. And she is, as I tell people, the shrine at the mountaintop. She is the guardian angel of the city, the cemetery. I'm going to go ahead and just put it out there. If there was ever a fated artist encounter, a meant-to-be moment for a human being called a sculptor, it's the moment that John Walls met the father of Gracie Watson, a man who just was so overcome by the loss of his daughter, their daughter, that he walked into the studio wordless, Wales Watson, 1889, March, I believe. He hands Walls a photograph of his daughter, turns around and leaves. And
oh, wow.
Walls, you know, I think the mystery is, when they bulldozed that house in the 70s, you know, did that photo go with it? And was it ever returned to the family? It doesn't seem that the family has a picture of Little Gracie, but nonetheless, I really, in my sort of romantic story mind, I want to imagine that John Walls came across Little Gracie. Because, you know, she dies the same year he shows up, and effectively. And so there would have been a brief window, it would be my guess. So did he see her? I don't know. That's just wishful thinking on my part. But was he touched by the spirit, or just the story? So, you know, she had died of sepsis within that week. And he figured, he learned pretty quickly that this was a world who loved Little Gracie. It was not just the parents. And, you know, and of course you've done the stories on Little Gracie, so I won't, you know, rehash that too much. But, you know, she was kind of this little Shirley Temple residence, and she sang and danced at the Pulaski Hotel, which her parents were proprietors of, on Johnson Square. And, you know, and cabin cruisers that came from New York City, they had magazines on the boats that talked about Gracie in the hotel, the tradition of finding Gracie and meeting her. And a year before her death, you could pay a photographer some money to take your portrait in the lobby with Little Gracie.
Oh, really? I haven't heard that.
She was a phenomenon. You know, when she died, you know, really at Easter, and I think it's interesting that her parents had maybe not baptized her when she was born in Charleston, in the Charleston Hotel on Meeting Street. And I don't know if she was baptized or not, because it's noted that 4 days before she died in Savannah, her parents rushed her to the Lutheran Church of the Ascension and had her baptized. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if they just changed religious faiths and
had
meant to get around to it, expecting her to live longer or
whatever. Yeah.
But, you know, John Walls set to task. Her parents really had nothing for a year and a half but this pile of dirt at her gravesite. And just one day in 1891, there's a ceremony and, you know, a cloth falls to the ground from really this marble apparition, kind of familiar of Gracie. And according to Walls's personal papers, her parents were so affected by seeing this lifelike presence that all they could even say to him before turning and leaving very emotionally was, "John, it's an exact likeness."
Aww.
And that was a high compliment.
Yeah.
And John, like all the other stone cutters in the United States before penicillin in 1928, before improved sewage, I mean, mm-hmm. what paid all their overhead were the monuments dedicated to infants and other young children and teenagers. That's what paid their overhead until 1928 with the advent of penicillin, and then in the 1930s improved sewage. So he was already familiar with the mode, mm-hmm. but I don't think that made it any easier.
Right.
You know, when a silent father walks into a studio and can barely lift the photograph and then say nothing. I mean,
yeah.
Lachelle, let me tell you, we're talking, I cannot count the number of tears that have fallen when I tell this story in front of that plot in 20 years. It's either a group effect or it's one, you know, mother or it's a couple of parents who you can tell have lost a child. I mean,
right.
It's sometimes hard for me to get through that story. I mean, there have been some tours that have seen me lose it, you know, like especially if I'm having a hard week and maybe I went through a breakup or something like that and I'm feeling a little low in myself and I'm trying to tell the crazy story. I'm like, excuse me while I weep over here.
Yeah.
You know, so it's tough, but
I've shed many tears at the graves of people that I've, you know, many, and you know, mostly our children, because it just is so tragic. It just seems so unfair. They're just so at the beginning of their beautiful life. And then you see these words that you know had to have come from their parents, inscribed in stone of just a bud, you know, that's not going to be able to flower. And
the little bud that never bloomed. But
well,
I'll tell you something, because you're a fellow taphophile. I'll tell you something that washed over me after many of these instances that it took me a long time to put it together because I was confused by it. And what I mean by that, I mean, my whole lifestyle is our graveyards, going to cemetery. Mm-hmm. This is what I do.
Right.
So what I kept noticing, particularly around North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, were these town, city, church graveyards, some cemeteries where there would be one ornate headstone to a child, and I turn and I look and I look, and there's no one else.
Mm.
And I'm like, wait.
Yeah.
Why is that so ornate? I mean, expensive is the meaning.
Yeah.
And no one else is around, no parents, no sister, no brother, whatever. And what I found out was that in that period, especially the Victorian period, and possibly prior Puritan, I don't know, but in the Victorian age, when the first child of the parents died, the church people and the town folk and the families would encourage those parents to leave the city to get past the death. Mm. But before they did, knowing that in 1825 they may never get back, they wanted to leave some great testament of the love they had held.
Oh, yeah.
And the memory, and to leave some statement of this memory and this suffering and this also love in one monument. And that is why you find so many singular child monuments.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe just random ones, but they're still out there. So I didn't understand that for a long time. Like, well, wait a second. Shouldn't there be mom and dad and the sisters and other siblings?
Right.
But those are often the cases. And of course, these all have different endings as family stories. But that is, I would say, a good bet if you yourselves out there find an old headstone of a child by itself and nobody else. That's in my estimate, probably what went down.
Right. Yep. That's exactly. We have a family
that's what happened to her parents, really. I mean,
yeah.
You know, after they sold the Pulaski Hotel, they basically ran the old DeSoto Hotel for a year and a half. And then we find them traveling, Gracie's parents traveling up north. And after that, it gets a little vague. And I've not heard too many people filling in the blanks or rushing to fill in the blanks. I think there's just some mystery about where it all transpired, except I think the view is that Gracie's death, you know, pushed them apart in some respect. They never, to my knowledge, shared another child together.
Oh, yeah.
And then we find Mom and Dad in unmarked graves in the Rural West Cemetery of Albany, New York. And that seems to be like the end of that branch of the family in some respect. And
wow,
you know, and then there's little Gracie left behind, as we say, to fend for herself, and it would eventually become a story of a town taking care of her.
Yes.
Or the public or her fans or what have you.
Right. And also I always think of all of the children, how many children her age are laid to rest in Bonaventure, you know, if only there could be that for every child.
Well, I tell people that Gracie is the face of all the children that have no headstones. She is the face of all the children whose names are not found in records.
Yeah.
She is the face and the story of all the children that have no headstones with their names. And what that means is that if there is no headstone, typically in a cemetery from 100 years ago, with a child's name, that means probably that child's name has not been spoken in a loving mouth or a kind mouth in 80 years or 100 years. And that's a very lonely idea.
Right.
So little Gracie is the memory of all the children, basically. She is the memory of them all. Mm-hmm.
That's really a great way of putting it. I like that.
I hope to bring you to tears in person one day.
We will look forward to that.
We shall bring the tissues. But you know, I'm going to go ahead and say this once more. There will never be another statue like little Gracie, because Georgia Marble is basically gone. God's stone made her. She is priceless. She is irreplaceable. And I wholly expect and am basically asking the population to continue to look out for her.
Yeah. She's surrounded by a gate and by bushes. You can't go up to it.
Michael Seebacher was the ironsmith that made that in 1999 for the Bonaventure Historical Society. He was a young gun ironsmith around Savannah for quite a bit, and actually have a bed made out of cemetery gates that he made.
What?
And
what?
Yeah.
Who has
a
bed made out of cemetery gates? This is amazing.
I do.
Where can I get one?
19th century. Right? Yeah, well, thankfully, I mean, you can get one from Michael, probably. I don't know where his status is, but anyway, but you know, I do kind of want to finish on this too, in that you know, it is one of the most time-honored traditions to go to Bonaventure to visit little Gracie and leave some object of affection at the grave. And so I want to instill here on your great show, Lachelle, that with 2020 and the way it impacted us all, one of the sad downturns of let's say secular rite is that all of the toys and everything that people used to bring Gracie, like all the kids that came to bring her, somehow that flatlined. And even now here in 2022, it's barely returned, and I think that's sad. And although the cemetery department may not want me to make that shout out, it's just that was a tradition way before me, and I will say that
I hope more people will
come back and put it out. I'm just putting it out there. People need to come visit little Gracie's. People need to donate money to the cleaning and the maintenance, and they and the kids need to come and write notes to her and leave cool things for Gracie, and everybody else do that too.
I love that. And there's also the Historical Society. I know that there's a way that you can get involved and donate through.
Yeah, I mean, the Bonaventure Historical Society is one element. And I don't want to take anything away from them, but I think sometimes if you're looking to expedite something without a committee or something in that sense, and I'm a member of the Bonaventure Historical Society, so don't get me wrong. But I think you can actually call the cemetery department within the city of Savannah and say, hey, I would like to sponsor a cleaning, and you know, of any monument that inspires you, actually, or one that you think is a little rough looking, and there are plenty of those. You can actually sponsor a cleaning, and they might point you to the Bonaventure Historical Society at that point, or they may actually turn you on to their preservation guy. But you know, either way, there are ways to do it.
Yeah, super interesting. That's a great way to help. I know that a lot of places do have friends of the cemetery, and sometimes they'll have cleaning days. And every cemetery is different in what they do and what they need. But it's great to get involved in some way.
Yeah, and of course, another way people can celebrate Little Gracie is next Saturday, or two Saturdays from now, July 9th, or I'm not sure when you're publishing, but July 9th,
right,
on Saturday, which is a day before her 140th birthday.
Aww.
Yeah, she doesn't look a day over six and a half. But on July 9th, I'm doing the second annual Little Gracie birthday tour and luncheon event. And that starts at 9 a.m. And Tina Arnsdorf, who made a Little Gracie statue cake last year, is doing the cake again this year. And she's a wonderful baker. Tina bakes, Tina Arnsdorf. Nonetheless, she did an awesome job with the Gracie cake last year, and she was so nervous about it because, you know, it is a Gracie statue cake.
Wow.
But she's amazing. And this year she's doing another, although we're going to do kind of a different style. But we'll do a 2.5-hour tour. It'll start at 9 a.m. on Saturday, July 9th, and it'll be dedicated to the life and times of Walls. And we'll obviously go to John Walls's grave and kind of finish with Little Gracie. But we'll talk about a lot of his statues and his art. And then if people choose to do the optional luncheon at Erica Davis Low Country, it'll be kind of a Q&A luncheon where obviously they'll get some cake, but they can order off of the menu. They can see some Gracie-related, John Walls-related objects on display, including one statue that I own of his that he did under Ami Mallet in Paris, France. It's a Michelangelo bronze, and that is in my collection.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And then...
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and then we're going to be unveiling for the attendees of the luncheon a John Walls statue, also from Paris in the 1870s, that I've had in my box, or I've had in a box in my living room for 2 months. I've been dedicated to not opening it so that we can open it for this special event.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and there's one other...
That's rough.
There's one other great surprise connected to Little Gracie's life and times, but I'm going to save that for attendees. But for anybody that wants to attend and participate, they can just go to shannonscotttours.com or shannonscott.com and sign up.
Oh, yeah. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
How neat.
So fly on out from Arizona, no big deal.
I know, no problem. I'll just run over. But yeah, I definitely want to come back. And when I do, we will get together and we can have a taffophile party.
Yeah, man, I love it, I love it, I love it. Well, there's an endless amount of material here. So thanks for being so great to Savannah with your endeavor, and I hope it continues to inspire others.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you for being
with
us today, Shannon Scott. And everybody, go take a Shannon Scott tour in Savannah, Georgia. So grateful that we could have Shannon Scott on the podcast today and talk about John Walls, the man made famous by his flawless sculptures. he died from a disease created by his amazing craft, and then waited 93 years for his own headstone to be made and placed. Feels so ironic for someone who did so many lovely pieces for others for so long. But we are also really grateful for his amazing talents and that we can go to Bonaventure and that they can be enjoyed by everyone. This was Stones, Bones, and Shadows.
You can see photos and more information about the cemeteries we explore and find our sources at StonesBonesAndShadowsPodcast.com. Also, don't forget to check us out on social media, including Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and even TikTok, where you can interact with us. As always, we love to hear from our listeners.
The extrovert, the